welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
If you believe in a punitive God, then my guests today are in for the fires of hell. Hello, welcome to Grumpy Old Religion on the Spirit of Things here on ABC Radio National. Actually, I sort of put them up to being grumpy about religion, so if anyone's going to burn, it'll be me. The truth is, we hear a lot on the Spirit of Things from people who've found the true way, the right path, the golden road to spiritual fulfillment. But that leaves a lot of us sitting around harumphing. We're not that happy, at least not all the time. On today's show, we have Star Grump, Dilly Keen from Grumpy Old Women, the hit British series which is touring Australia. Best-selling author Tom Keneally is back to whinge about religion, and David Tacey, who teaches at the University of La Trobe's Department of Critical Inquiry, is actually paid to be critical about religion. Fancy that. Now don't go thinking it's all too negative for you. There are plenty of laughs and some profound insights too. Dilly Keen's been treading the boards for a few years in comedy shows in London, with Fascinating Aida having a 5-season run on the West End. She's a songwriter and columnist, and of course one of the principal players in Grumpy Old Women, written by Judith Holder. Dilly, one of the great things about reaching a certain age is that you get to speak your mind and be grumpy and call a spade a spade. But is that actually true about religion? Is that still taboo?
I think people are a little chary about speaking badly of religion. But, I mean, there's a very strong movement, particularly in Britain, that's afoot at the moment, which is the sort of the atheists are beginning to speak out about their own faith, which is, of course, a lack of faith, or in some case a loss of faith, in some case there never was any faith. And so atheism's got quite a strong following in the UK right now, and people are getting very grumpy under that banner about religion.
Do you think they're behaving any worse than the parsons and priests that they criticise?
Oh, I think they can probably be accused of just as much arrogance as any.
Well, certainly England isn't immune from the kind of enthusiasm we've seen in America. In fact, Nikki Gumbel, who established the Alpha Ministries, has been so successful, and he represents that really strong evangelical wing of Anglicanism. Have you seen that around?
I avoid evangelicals wherever possible. I have a cousin who's an evangelical Catholic. He's a serious happy-clappy, and he travels miles every Sunday to get to this special happy-clappy super-evangelical church where he can strum his guitar and clap his hands and, I don't know, balance tambourines on his head for all I know. And quite frankly, I can't bear it. I can't bear the sort of, you know, let us all join in and praise the Lord. Because basically, I was brought up in England. My family are Irish Catholics. And so I've got the worst of both worlds, which is having the English bit of me. I'm just a bit embarrassed about all that. And because we don't give easily. We're trained to be uneasy from birth. And also, Irish Catholics are sort of an unmaneuverable and an unwhippable bunch, really. The English all pray together, whereas the Irish pray completely. They'll begin the Our Father, and within about a half a sentence, they're all completely out of sync with one another.
Is that very disturbing to you? I mean, do you remember that as a young person?
I remember going to a church in the west of Ireland and saying, they don't pray in time with one another, Mum.
Well, I imagine one of the things that must really upset you about the happy clappies is they don't allow themselves to be very grumpy.
Oh, goodness me, they're appallingly happy. It's like people who've been ested. They smile all the time.
Ested? You're referring to est, right?
Yes. Can't you be ested if you belong to est or you've done est or whatever it is? They sort of smile with a sort of glazed smile. My cousin in particular, he's a ghastly individual. At his own mother's funeral, he sang a song with a guitar. He's got a very bad voice. And he's several thousand miles away, so I can be very rude about him. But it was the most awful song. Anyway, I went up to him afterwards. I said, well, Raymond, that was an interesting song. Where did you learn that? He said, I wrote it myself. He said, with this beatific smile. And I said, oh, well, I'm sorry about your mum. Sorry she died. And he said, ah, yes, she is with the risen Eucharist at the moment. And he smiled again beatifically. And I thought, risen Eucharist, that's a paradox, isn't it?
That's a new one on me, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, the problem with weddings and funerals these days is that they're often serviced by unfortunate parsons and priests who I feel very sorry for, because they don't know the members of the family, and they're doing their best to try and usher in a couple into wedlock, or usher some poor soul out with a few well-chosen words, which have usually been supplied by Auntie Eva or Uncle Dennis, because the rest of the family are in too much shock and grief. And so inevitably they refer to wrong facts about things. And I feel quite sorry for them. So I get slightly irritated by people who want the church for high days, but nothing else.
Well, that brings to mind the young gals who want a white wedding, but a week before walk around like sort of little trampettes, and suddenly they want to look like Snow White.
Well, yes, I had a terrible argument with quite a good friend of mine who didn't understand why she couldn't marry a divorcee in church. And I tried to explain it to her, and she just went, oh, well, that's stupid. And I said, well, you may think it's stupid, and you're entitled to think it's stupid, but it's the rule. And she said, well, I want it. I want to get married. And I said, but you don't go to church. And she said, well, that's nothing to do with it. I just want a nice wedding. And she simply didn't see that there was a correlation between, you know, the fact that she wasn't allowed to marry in church. Eventually she ended up having a blessing. She said, well, it's the same thing, isn't it? I said, well, no, it isn't. And she wanted me to be her daughter's godmother. And I said, I don't think I can be if you're not going to actually christen the child. And she said, well, what's that got to do with it? I said, God, mother. The two words go together to form godmother. Therefore, I am the representative of the religious life. She went, no, you're there for presents. So I wasn't course. Godmother. I didn't mean to be a bit grumpy about that, because I mean, she was great fun and she was a good friend. But I mean, she simply didn't have any idea of why the church has rules. I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying I agree with the rules particularly, but they are the rules, and it's rather like sort of saying, but I want to drive up a one-way street the wrong way, and say, well, you can if you want, but it's going to get you in trouble. Or it's just, you know, it's not how the traffic's organised.
Dilly, does it bother you that so many young people actually don't know the first thing about religion?
I think religion's done so much harm in history. It's also done a huge amount of good, I know that, but it has done an awful lot of harm, and it's quite frightening at the moment with the rise of fundamentalism on the one hand, obviously, Islam, and on the other side, you know, fundamental Christianity. That, in a way, I sympathise with people saying, I'm not going to bring my children up with any great religion, religious feeling. So I feel sad that the more spiritual side of religion is ignored. But I think it's a fact of life. We're drifting towards atheism on the one hand and drifting back into fundamentalism on the other. And of the two, I prefer atheism.
In the 70s, were you at all attracted to TM, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, all of the gurus that certainly the Beatles were looking toward for a while there, and then a whole bunch of other very well-known people?
I suppose I was attracted kind of in the idea, but, you know, I wanted to become an actress. And that required sticking around. So I stuck around in London. The other thing is I'm profoundly lazy about things I'm only half interested in. And also, I mean, I don't think I really wanted to go to an ashram in India. And third world toilets have no great attraction for me. And whilst they may have marvellous plumbing, and I'm being, you know, facile and foolish, the whole thing of it just really didn't appear to me. No, I'm sort of more of a Catholic than anything else, and I kind of stick around in a rather lazy and hopeless way.
Well, you mentioned Est, and of course that's a kind of substitute for church. It's a kind of a spirituality. People thought they'd be able to understand the profound meaning of life and also get hold of it and achieve great success. Do you encounter that in the world of acting?
I know an actor who's been ested, and he's one of the most alarming people. And he's the kind of person who asks your birth sign. And I've got great distrust about that. I'm rather a bolshy individual. I don't like being bossed into happiness and being a typical Gemini or whatever.
One of the things that happens when you get to a certain age is you get grumpy, or you decide that there's an antidote to grumpiness. And some people have found that in the mind-body-spirit movement, in the foothills of Tibet following a lama. When you see women of your age doing that, what do you think?
I feel rather sorry for them. In my other life, I write songs, write comic and satirical songs, and I wrote a song called The One True Religion Is Me. And it's all about the pick-and-mix religion, you know, a little bit of this and a bit of the Dalai Lama, a bit of Zen, a bit of Buddhism. It's a kind of terribly convenient religion. I once saw this woman wandering around looking absolutely marvellous. She was in Canterbury Cathedral, which was I was looking around, and she was dressed in a lovely white tunic and pants, and she had a very elegant turban. And next thing is, three more of these women came round. Me and my friend said, "Excuse me, are you part of any religion?" And she said, "Oh yes, we're Sikhs." And I thought, "Mm-hmm, I see. They were American Sikhs. They were designer Sikhs. I mean, they were dressed as male Sikhs would be. Female Sikhs don't dress like that. So they were classic, you know, women who had decided that they liked the fancy costume. That's what it looked like. And, you know, Madonna reading Kabbalah. You know, Kabbalah's ancient book of lights. The study was for men only. And within Judaism, Kabbalah is regarded with huge sort of skepticality. It's a bit like, you know, joining P2.
What's
P2? P2 is that very, very esoteric branch of the Masons, which is populated by high-born Spanish Catholics.
Right.
And a few Romans as well.
So you haven't encountered fellow actresses with the scarlet string around their wrist?
No, I haven't, no. Mercifully.
Well, it sounds like Madonna's retreating from her former enthusiasm for Kabbalah.
The thing is, I think these things are passing fads. And I feel very strongly about religion. I mean, I think there was this man called Jesus, and he did extraordinary things. And that's sort of as far as I can get. I don't know whether there's an afterlife. I don't know whether there's a God. But there was a man called Jesus who kind of showed a way of peace and kindness. And that's been hijacked along the way by all sorts of factions. But I think he's my religion, if you like. That's my thing. I can't be doing with crystals and healing and, you know, the borrowing easy little bits of other people's religions without ever going deeply into those religions. I mean, they could be playing mahjong for all that it means anything.
Well, Prince Charles seems to be very interested in alternative spiritualities. Do you think he's been at all encouraging this kind of exploration or move away from the established Anglican Church?
No, I don't. What he is he's terribly interested in Islam, and he's also very green, quite green, and he's very organic. And those are rather separate. I mean, organic, you know, is followed with great passion, but it isn't a religion yet. And he is interested in Islam because he's got a very big Islamic constituency in the country. And he sees much good in Islam, of course, which there is. And I think he could be, he's at the moment, you know, the jury's out on it, but he could be a force for some kind of reconciliation between Islam and whatever you like to call it, Christianity, Episcopalianism, Anglicanism. But no, I don't think he hasn't got a huge pulling power.
Mm. Well, Dilly, you've been famous for touring Fascinating Aida, as well as Grumpy Old Women. Now, they're both fairly influenced by feminist ideas. So would you see some of the manifestations of Islam at the moment a little bit worrying?
I do find Islam rather terrifying for women. Yes, I do. That's a straight answer. I think there is much that's likeable and admirable in Islam, I also think there's a lot that's really, really scary. And when you see women covered from head to toe, without even the slits for eyes in some cases, I can't understand what that has to do with God. But Islam is it orthopraxic, isn't it? In that the practice of Islam is almost more important than what's going on in your head.
In the show Grumpy Old Women, especially in England, is there any kind of allusion to those sorts of things that are going on?
No, there aren't any allusions in. It's strictly about the domestic day-to-day horrors of living, the grumbles, the gripes, the things that get you down, or the things that sometimes you love, or your secret little enjoyments. Jenny has stayed off religion, I think, and Judith, the two writers, I think wisely, because it divides people so much, and what you want to do in the theatre is unite people in having a very amusing, good time. I've always stayed off religion, apart from this very, very easy sideswipe at the pick-and-mix religionists.
What sort of character do you play in the show?
Well, in the script it says Woman 3. So I've beefed about this. I've grumbled. I've said, Woman 3. That gives me no indication. But basically we play extensions of ourselves. I suppose my character is the posh one. That's what Jenny says. Jenny says, I'm the posh one. Linda is a wonderful Cockney from London, and Jenny says she's the in-betweeny, she's perfect.
Are you a real posh one, or are you like Madam Bucket?
No, okay. I am quite posh. I live with a farmer, and we go to hunt bulls and things like that. But it's a bit, I should think it's much more like Australia, because it's sort of wonderfully, you know, quite less, the English countryside is much less posh than everybody else thinks it is, because actually, the fact that it's under siege, I think, from our government at the moment, means that everybody bands together. And you will hear every sort of accent at the hunt balls, and it's very collegiate, it's very collective, and it's very community-minded. It's lovely. So the fact that I'm posh really has very little bearing on the way I live my life.
But as a posh number 3, you would be very interested in preserving the little church in the village,
very much.
In the town, yes.
Oh, absolutely, yes. And fighting off the onslaught of modern destruction. Jenny, on the other hand, is a real modernist. So it's actually wonderful for us to work together and have the two points of view. We don't argue about it.
Do you think posh number 3 would approve of female vicars?
I do approve of female vicars, actually, because I don't see, if there is such a thing as God, therefore, if there is such a thing as the word of God, how can it be sullied by the speaker? If a priest, a male priest, can be a, you know, serial sinner, if the cardinal, the Bishop of Galway, can be living with a woman and have a grown-up son, and yet the word of God is not sullied, then why can't a woman speak the word of God and perform services and have the word of God
indeed,
not be sullied?
Indeed, and be as grumpy as men. It's been wonderful having you on The Spirit of Things. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
What a delight is Dilly Keen, who's touring Australia with the stage show Grumpy Old Women. Look on our website for details. That's at abc.net.au/religion and follow the link to The Spirit of Things. Coming up, Tom Keneally. Now, Tom is an indefatigable optimist, I think, and he showed some of that on the programme recently when he was talking about his favourite poets. But today we're staying away from metaphors and mystifying poetry, and we're being blunt, crabby, irritated and peeved. In short, we're being grumpy about religion. Tom Keneally, it's wonderful to have you on Grumpy Old Religion. And I want to ask you, what makes you grumpy about religion?
It's a particular attitude people have to some wars, such as the conflicts in Northern Ireland or the conflicts in Iraq, that they're really based on religion, and we wouldn't do that. So one of the things that makes me grumpy about religion is that it is blamed for wars when wars are always, and conflict is always, about human rights, real estate, cultural identity. In particular, however, I think cherchez la real estate, it should be the slogan for all wars. But then religion itself is what annoys me is its legalism, and particularly the legalism of strict Orthodox Catholicism and other religions. I think that the idea that you go to heaven by obeying the rules is really an insult upon the mercy of God. If Christ died for our sins, and yet God is still waiting there for us to slip up and commit one by not going to Mass on Sunday or by finding an unexpected homosexual impulse in oneself, then he's just waiting for that so that you can be condemned to the pit of hell. And I distrust these churchmen who are legalistic, who say a good practitioner is a person who does this, that, or the other. I think of Auschwitz. The man who commanded Auschwitz was Hus, and he was a good Catholic, and he went to confession and communion before his execution for absolutely heinous crimes. So he goes to heaven, but some poor ordinary Catholic fitter and turner in the suburbs who gets married outside the church is going to hell? That's what the rules say. So I am a great enemy of legalism in religion. The proposition that Christ is about love. Caritas Christi urget nos. We are moved to action by the love of Christ. Oh yeah, but we can't give communion to homosexuals. No, we can't give communion to the divorced. They're all second-class citizens. And of course, Presbyterians are okay, but they don't, and Buddhists, but they don't belong to the one true church. And so I feel that religion can be hugely undemocratic, of course, and autocratic and totalitarian, but it is the spirit of legalism that drives out the spirit of Christ. The Gospels themselves say that Christ was upbraided by the respectable people of his time for mixing with the unwashed and the unredeemed and the unlegalistic, the people who were not good Jews. Yet modern religion commits the same fault. And the idea we love the sinner but we hate the sin, well, it turns into the same thing pretty much when you sort of burn or exclude the sinner to get rid of the sin. And so I can't be appalled enough by legalism. And of course, legalism is at odds with liberal democratic principles.
Are you actually saying then that the church is getting in the way of true religion? Is it the church that behaves in this way and is kind of standing as a barrier between the individual and God?
That's what I feel like. There's an extreme emphasis on gender in Catholic legalism. To become a bishop, you have to say that you believe in Humanae Vitae, the encyclical about birth control, and that you will oppose any movement, any opinion about the ordination of women. And these both seem to me to be such crazy proposition to base a bishopric upon when Christ's chief command was to love one another, and when he told people to consider the lily of the fields, when he told them that the meek will inherit the earth. This isn't the meek inherit the earth. This is men in long gowns using the law as an axe and an implement of exclusion. It is not the charity of Christ moving them. It is love for pontifical law moving them. And I feel there's a gulf between the two. Now, I'm aware that many other ruined Catholics, I've never been able to deal in my life with that getting to the true religion beyond the bishops and the apparatchiks. And I know many Catholics who do. Now, an ABC employee, Geraldine Doogue, she is still a faithful daughter of the church, but she's more than a daughter, of course. She's also a stirrer, God bless her. And she is able to get to the humanity of it beyond the legalism, these people. But many of us have great trouble. So we're kind of tribal Catholics. We can't quite leave it alone. We can't, that we've kind of left the church, but it won't leave us. And we're trying to puzzle out the relationship between legalism and that charity of Christ. Another thing that I've got to say, that as I've got older, I begin to think that the true religions of humanity are humanism and ancestor worship. Not that our ancestors are really gods, but that their experience, their human experience and their human suffering somehow is holy, and that we need to draw on their experience, which can't be decanted into our souls directly, but can perhaps be... genealogy is a form of ancestor worship, where we go back and try to find the trials through which our ancestors came. And we've got a profound sense that this will fortify us spiritually. Similarly, animism. I've been to the great Christian sites in Ireland where you climb Croagh-Patrick, the mountain from which St. Patrick expelled the saints. The serpents. And at various stages up that mountain, there are various holy rocks, which have obviously been there from Celtic times, Celtic religious times, Druidic times, and you circle them saying various prayers. And then you go on to the next clump of rocks. And at the top, what do you find? A great clump of rocks. And the idea of God in the landscape, of gods and demigods and spirits in the landscape, is something that's very natural to me. I've gone more in a... I was once a Christian. I've become an animist, I think.
Well, it's redolent of the Old Testament. The Gaelic call them cairns, but in the Old Testament, they were rocks. They were shrines to God. I wonder whether, on your recent visit to India, did you find any lessons for the church there?
Definitely. I think one of the biggest problems with the way we have constructed God as Christians is that he is an all-powerful engineer of the world. He can intervene and save you personally. So, for example, if you were a good Catholic when I was a kid, you said three Hail Marys before you set off on a road trip. If you got there at the end, it was due to God's goodness. But if you were killed along the way, it was part of his inscrutable will. So the problem of evil, of bad things happening, is a great problem for Christianity, because God is so omnipotent, so personal. One of the things I like about Judaism is that God is someone you argue with. As in the Old Testament, you know, God is right there for Moses to argue with and for Abraham to argue with. And God, I notice, is treated by some Holocaust survivors I know as a sort of over-imaginative, brilliant nephew who has written the world like a turbulent screenplay, and who has to be reasoned with so much. An old Jewish bloke said to me, when I went to Mauthausen and there was that quarry cliff and the SS throwing people over it, I said, God, this has gone far enough. Now, that God, this has gone far enough, is not the Christian way. God, you're supposed to say, God, this is your will. But if this is your will, an immediate immediate question arises. How is this going to perfect me? It's going to kill me, but it's not going to perfect me. It's going to barbarize me and them. And so I like dualism in my gods. I think the only answer is dualism, like Shiva and Kali in the Hindu religion.
That's certainly a much more playful kind of religion. There are a lot more manifestations of God, of Vishnu, who can be engaged in quite jovial ways. Do you think Christianity could use a lot more opportunity for mirth and fun?
Oh, yes. Now, we are told that God made us in our image. Any hard-up preacher in any boring church on any Sunday will tell us that. Well, how about the fact that we are so irreverent by nature and we like to send things up? Is this in God's image? No, it's only in God's image if you don't choke, if you keep yourself zipped most of your life, and if you go to Mass and Communion and complete your Easter duty and give to the church and have all the sacraments. That's all it's meant by it. Whereas we are... the fact that we are sexual beings must mean that God is, in some sense, a sexual being too. The fact that we are laughing creatures must mean that he is a laughing creature too. And I see this in early Christianity, where St. Brigid, who is this saint based on a Celtic earth mother, there is a 6th century poem by her, 7th century, that says, I imagine heaven as a huge lake of beer, around which all the faithful sit, drinking with the Holy Family. Now, that geniality that was in early Christianity and was in Brigid has, tends to be replaced now by sour legalism. And that is what Catholics are finding so hard to live with. At every turn, they are presented with rules of observance instead of rules of love. And they are presented with the strict letter of the law. And the strict letter of the law does cut through lives like a power saw. So you've got to question it. Okay, they say, but you've got to believe it's all for the best. All this human suffering is all for the best. And if Indians and Africans don't use birth control and they get HIV, that is part of some mysterious plan too. Well, I'm sorry, I don't have that much faith. And I don't like to live in a world where human suffering is part of such, occurs on such a massive scale. Where is God's connivance in that? If you live in Australia, God smiles on you pretty much. But if you live in Africa, is God in Africa? You know, is there God in Africa, their legalistic God? And what's he getting out of 40% of the population having being AIDS carriers? Of course, again, the answer is, oh, but you've got to believe. Well, you know, we're humans, and if we are made in God's image, our skepticism is part of that image too. We are questioning man. Aristotle said that man was homo risibilis. That was his way of distinguishing us from other animals. We were men, or species, humankind, that could laugh. He thought that was the distinctive. I would say that we're also homo sportivus, because you don't see cows playing games or composing operas. And I think we're homo scepticus too. Our scepticism is if you believe in this whole God, and I'm not sure that I do, God making us in his image, our scepticism is part of that inheritance also. So does God like the questioner, the man and woman who argues with him? I think he probably likes him better than the man who's scared, I was going to say something improper, who's scared stiff by him.
Tom, have you always been grumpy? I mean, you did train as a priest at one time, so has your grumpiness grown?
No, my grumpiness has diminished. The less I got hung up on the law and extreme orthodoxy, the more jovial I became. So I'm not grumpy about the things that the people on the show, grumpy old men, grumpy old women, are. I think that compared to the... I still like parties. I still like skiing. I still like going out. I still like... I'm starting to get sick of international travel, you know. So I don't consider myself grumpy, but boy, I've had a whinge here today, haven't I?
You have indeed. Glad to know he still likes parties. He'd be the life of any party with that jovial disposition. Tom's new book is The Widow and the Hero, and he's our grumpy number two today. Coming up, grumpy number three. You're with the Spirit of Things on ABC Radio National, online and podcast, so you can have a second or third or fourth listen on your personal player. To download this program, just go to our website at abc.net.au/religion to get the details.
Every time I look at you, I don't understand why you let the things you did get so out of hand. You'd have managed better if you'd had it planned.
I don't know about you, but I find being grumpy exhilarating. It must unleash some serotonin in the brain. It certainly breaks through the polite barriers and high walls that sometimes surround religion. David Tacey has spent years calling spirituality and religion to account in his books, like Edge of the Sacred and more recently, The Spirituality Revolution. He's speaking to me from Melbourne.
Jesus Christ, who are you? What have you sacrificed? Jesus.
David, welcome to Grumpy Old Religion.
Thank you very much.
Well, David, you were among the very first in Australia to look seriously at people who weren't taking religion very seriously. Your book sort of invited us to really explore why people were leaving the churches. And now with studies like The Spirituality of Generation Y, haven't your views been pretty much vindicated?
Oh, I suppose so. I think early on I was interested in Australian culture broadly, and I was interested in this perception that Australians weren't religious. And yet the more I looked at Australian art and literature and music and painting and cartooning, the more religious it seemed. And so I had to kind of draw a distinction between religion and church, I guess. And I felt that religiousness is endemic in the Australian consciousness, in our culture, but that because it's not churchy, it falls off the radar. I suppose a lot of my work is trying to show that Australians are far more concerned about God, if you will, than church, and that we make a distinction between the two that, of course, the churches don't do. And so because Australians don't go to church, it looks to the churches like we're godless. Mm. And I suppose a lot of my wrangling and concern is to ask the churches to please take a more generous view of the human spirit and its capacity to know and experience God. And of course, this is a big ask. I mean, I was very foolish, I think, at the start to think that the churches would even be interested in my work. Some of them got interested, some of the so-called progressives, but on the whole, I got short shrift from the churches, I think. Probably that's what I guess planned on getting.
So they're pretty grumpy about you getting grumpy about them not handling spirituality seriously enough or in more creatively, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, when I started my work, I really did think that churches could change and that we could get them on track with this enormous interest in today's society in spirituality. But no, I think the thing is that we have to whittle the structures right down further and further, and The basic problem is that religious institutions asking people to believe in an age of science. I think that's the real issue. It's not that people have lost faith in God or lost the hunger for God. In fact, I think God hunger is stronger now than possibly ever before. But it's this belief problem that Australians aren't great at believing. And I think that the churches have failed dramatically in being able to present a way into religion that doesn't involve believing this set of dogmas or this set of miracles and wonders. And that's been my gripe and my kind of grumpiness, really, at the kind of self-destructive nature of religion, formal religion in Australia, the way it doesn't, it seems to want to die with its boots on. It doesn't really want to change. And it becomes quite pietistic and self-righteous about, well, we're going to stick to what we know, and although we might slide into the sea, at least we'll be true to the very end. Well, bugger that. I mean, it's just, to me, it's a way of forfeiting their spiritual authority to not provide a way in to religion that is acceptable by at least some of the population.
But David, back in the 60s and even in the 70s, the churches were certainly willing to incorporate kind of new forms of worship. You know, there were all of those folksy liturgies, the guitars, you know, people walking around looking like Jesus or what they thought.
John Lennon.
John Lennon. Mm. How do you look back on that time?
With a good deal of embarrassment, I think. I mean, those things had to happen. I mean, religion, formal religion at that point, realised the ship was going down and it had to do something. But it's the proverbial moving the deck chairs on the Titanic. And I don't care whether you celebrate with an organ or a guitar or drums. And I mean, we've got to sort of throw out a great deal in religion and get back to experience. That's the Australian need, the Australian hunger, is to begin with experience, not to begin with belief. And so a lot of those experimentations of the 60s strike me as kind of superficial and meaningless. I mean, I certainly wasn't interested in them myself. They left me very cold, and they were very transitory and haven't endured.
So were you grumpy with those kind of hippie versions?
Yeah, I was annoyed with the so-called alternative or the new church movement, and I just thought it was just radical enough. These so-called radicals in the churches who were trying to just tinker with the fine-tuning and change the sort of the way things appeared rather than look at the actual essence of the problem, which was the fact that Australians on the whole can't believe in things like virgin births and physical resurrections. And these are the real issues. In other words, they were just, to me, denying the intellectual problems at the heart of formal religion and sort of fussing around on the surface. So I was very irritated.
Well, some baby boomers responded to that problem by saying, when they had kids, I'm not going to impose the church or my religion on you. You can choose for yourself when you grow up. Yeah. Did that work?
Oh, yeah, that's a notorious thing, isn't it? The number of lost people who I talk to, who I say, you know, did you have a religious upbringing? And people say, no, my parents said I could choose myself and make my own decisions. And they say that in all sort of honesty and with an earnestness. But I actually think my answer to that is yes and no, in the sense that no, it didn't work because people were lost instead of chose their own direction. They just got lost. Certainly Generation X was very lost, I think, about these matters. I'd come back with a yes, however. It did work in part because in Generation Y, we see today this rising, more intense focus on spirituality in young people today, a seriousness about the pursuit of religious matters, which we didn't see in Generation X. So, to some extent, this baby boomer idea may have had a good effect, but as it were, it missed a generation.
Well, I know you've done a lot of exploratory research on youthful spirituality. So are you hopeful? Do you think that this seriousness is genuine and has depth?
I think it's genuine and has depth, but it needs help. And I don't know who's going to help it. Buddhism may be the religion to provide the help because it values experience so much. But any religion that's basically about believing this set of dogmas is not going to help the current young people in their spiritual searches today. So I'm very, very pessimistic about Christianity's ability to speak to young people's spirituality, more optimistic about Buddhism, although I'm not a Buddhist myself, but I can see why it's working and how it's speaking to young people. But I guess, you know, to some extent, there's a lot of optimism in youth spirituality, but I'm not always sure if it's always well-founded. I think sometimes people say, yeah, my spirituality's fine, thanks, and then you look at their lives and it seems rather sad. Spirituality for young people gets a lot of good press, but I don't know if, to a large extent, some of that is actually illusory.
Mm. Well, David, the most prominent promoters these days of contemporary spirituality preach that guilt is bad for you. You know, something like original sin is a terrible thing to be burdened with. What do you think?
Yes, I think, again, this is an overreaction to the kind of negativity of the mainline churches. The mainline churches have been very bogged down in original sin and telling people how sinful they are, and they can't find God within because they're just full of sin and they have to put their self to one side and do good works for others. And then you get a reaction to that, which is that there's an original blessing, that we are blessed, and that sin suddenly becomes unfashionable. And you can hear from what I'm saying that I don't believe that at all. I think that the truth lies somewhere in the middle, and I do think that guilt is very important. It's an educative, refining and civilizing influence. Too much guilt crushes the personality and makes you unable to grow and to move, experiment. But a certain amount of guilt seems to me to be absolutely essential for spiritual and religious development. That is ignored by the fashionable view that guilt's out.
The last 30 years, we've had a lot of New Age promoters, a lot of gurus telling us that we can be anything we want to be, just leave off that old-time religion and create something new that's based on the self, the God within. Has it been a good thing? How would you estimate or how would you judge the last 30 years of the New Age injection into our spirituality?
Well, yeah, I think the New Age is something that was inevitable. I mean, there had to be a movement eventually that said, look, you've got to find God within, instead of this traditional emphasis totally on God outside ourselves. The problem is there hasn't been enough differentiation about what the within is. Although in Hinduism and Buddhism they talk about the God within and the inner self and the Atman, we in the West don't distinguish between the true self, as Thomas Merton would call it, and the false self or the ego. And so there's been a lot of kind of grotesque, I think, misunderstanding about the God within. The God within is not your or my ego. The God within is not the power principle, my will power. The God within is actually something that often thwarts my will, that opposes my interests and directions. And so I would say that on the whole, while I understand where the New Age is coming from and why it had to happen, I'd say there's been a colossal failure of understanding because we have such little depth psychological knowledge, I guess, about the interior life and how we need to work it. We have to distinguish between our ego and the God within, which is coming from a different place.
David, do you think it's in the nature of religion and spirituality that we have to wrestle with it, that it does make us grumpy?
Oh, yeah, we have to wrestle with it. We've got to ask questions. We've got to doubt. And I think this is the big thing today. Doubt's very educative and very important to say, well, I don't think that's true. And then you find your experience might contradict that particular negative, rejecting point of view. But we have to wrestle. It's definitely the case. Questioning, wrestling, and always trying to be self-critical of our religious orientation is very important. And this is very new to all the Western-style religions, which have asked us to believe and not to doubt or question. So I think questioning and doubting is the way forward, and it's the fire in which the faith is actually formed in the heat of that kind of passion.
What about criticizing other people's religion? We've been in a period now in which we've been generating a lot of tolerance and interfaith dialogue and a great deal of reticence, some people say political correctness, about criticizing things that conflict with our views and values in other people's religion. What do you think? Have we been overly tolerant, or have we not been tolerant enough?
I think on the whole, Australians in particular tend to want to say to people, well, whatever turns you on, if this is what is true for you, then that's fine by me. And that kind of tolerance, well, it stops us from killing each other in the streets and from getting overexcited and overheated about religious matters, but it actually stifles debate. I think there's a level of our tolerance which is very bland and detracts from religious passion. I would like to see more passion brought back into debates, religious debates in Australia, but, you know, the passion can't get out of hand, so that we start abusing each other for following the wrong path or having the wrong God or having some false idea and some true idea. So clearly we need a religious pluralism, but I can't see why it can't be passionate pluralism rather than something that's just bland and empty.
Well, Australians are proverbially described as laid back. Do you think an Australian spirituality would have that passion in it?
Yeah, I think it would, but it might be a rather an inward passion, a rather deep passion that perhaps doesn't always become public. I think there's a tendency in Australian culture over the last, 200 years to have strong ideas about the spirit, but not always to want to broadcast those ideas publicly. There's a sort of a preference for interiority and quietness. So I think laid back, yeah, we're not going to be broadcasting our notions publicly, but we hold, I think many of us hold quite strongly and tenaciously to our personal beliefs, and I think that's a good sign.
Finally, David, there's a lot of research now that says being good and being nice to people is good for your health. It may even be good for you past the pearly gates. Do you think there are any health merits, indeed any spiritual merits, in being grumpy, inventing spleen?
Yeah, well, I think just as people are saying it's good to be nice, I think there's just as many people today saying it's good to be angry. I mean, people have a lot of anger about religion, for instance. You know, I mean, many people feel deluded, as if churches and synagogues and have led them up the garden path. There is a lot of anger in our community about religion. I'd like to see more of that anger come out, because behind it might be something very real. I think being grumpy is good. It's difficult because, you know, if you're grumpy, then people might want to back away from you, and certainly institutions might want to back away and completely disown you. But then again, you know, you have to back your own grumpiness and support it. It needs moral support.
Three cheers for grumpiness.
Yeah.
David Tacey is professor in the Department of Critical Inquiry at La Trobe University in Melbourne. Details of his latest book, How to Read Jung, will be on our website at abc.net.au/religion. Well, now that we've let off steam, we're probably a lot nicer to be with for a while. Grumpy Old Religion was brought to you by me and Jeff Wood, who I'm glad to say is not grumpy very often. Our sound engineer this week is Roy Huberman. Next week, put on your walking shoes, because we're going to be pilgrims. The pilgrimage is twofold, first to England, then to Santiago de Compostela. One, a sentimental journey, the other, a surprising encounter with the harsh realities of a superhighway of pilgrims. Join me, Rachel Kahn, next week on The Spirit of Things for Pilgrims. Thank you.
been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.